Welcome back to week four of Ripped from the Headlines. First of all, thank you very, very much, Doctor, for submitting this first article here. It's quite the interesting read. It's a little bit longer than what we usually do, but I did manage to fit it on here in slightly smaller font, so apologies to those of you who need to hold your reading glasses a little closer. So, gene-edited food is coming, but will shoppers buy? So let's hear a little bit about this. Washington, the next generation of biotech food is headed for the grocery aisles. And first up may be salad dressings or granola bars made with soybean oil genetically tweaked to be good for your heart. By early next year, the first foods from plants or animals that had their DNA edited are expected to begin selling. It's a different technology than today's controversial genetically modified foods, more like faster breeding that promises to boost nutrition, spur crop growth, and make farm animals hardier and fruits and vegetables last longer. The U.S. National Academy of Sciences has declared gene editing one of the breakthroughs needed to improve food production so the world can feed billions more people amid a changing climate. Yet, governments are wrestling with how to regulate this powerful new tool. And after years of confusion and rancor, will shoppers accept gene-edited foods or view them as GMOs in disguise? If the consumer sees the benefit, I think they'll embrace the products and worry less about the technology, says Dan Voitis, a University of Minnesota professor and chief science officer for Calixt Inc., which edited soybeans to make the oil heart healthy. Researchers are pursuing more ambitious changes. Wheat with triple the usual fiber, or that's low in gluten. Mushrooms that don't brown, and better producing tomatoes. Drought-tolerant corn, and rice that no longer absorbs soil pollution as it grows. Dairy cows that don't need to undergo painful dehorning, and pigs immune to a dangerous virus that can sweep through herds. Scientists even hope gene editing eventually could save species from being wiped out by devastating diseases like citrus greening, a so far unstoppable infection that's destroying Florida's famed oranges. First, they must find genes that could make a new generation of trees immune. If we can go in and edit the gene, change the DNA sequence ever so slightly by one or two letters, potentially we'd have a way to defeat this disease, says Fred Gmitter, a geneticist at the University of Florida Citrus Research and Education Center, as he examined diseased trees in a grove near Fort Meade, Florida. So anyways, this is sort of the introduction to talking about DNA editing foods having the powers to do all this amazing stuff to foods. So far, so good. We'll talk a lot more about it, and it's comparison to genetically modified foods in just the next paragraph here, but I will note that pig is still not going to be kosher even if we genetically edit it. It is interesting. I actually did see someone bring this up. That's the truth. The possibility that different science advances can perhaps allow us to, in some ways, and we talk about this with producing meat without actually slaughtering an animal and how that'll work. That's another topic that we're not talking about today, but people do talk about the possibility of having quote-unquote kosher pig as produced.
I did a share on this about a year ago. Right.
So anyways, and they bring in all sorts of interesting agotic material, but that's not our point here. Right? We're going to assume that pigs are still non-kosher. But on the other hand, we do get to talk about some of the other aspects going on here. So genetically modified or edited, what's the difference? And this is absolutely key to our discussion. We're really going to discuss starting from genetically modified and moving towards genetically edited. So farmers have long genetically manipulated crops and animals by selectively breeding to get offspring with certain traits. It's time-consuming and can bring trade-offs. Modern tomatoes, for example, are larger than their pea-sized wild ancestor, but the generations of crossbreeding made them more fragile and altered their nutrients. GMOs, or genetically modified organisms, are plants or animals that were mixed with another species' DNA to introduce a specific trait, meaning they're transgenic. Best known are corn and soybeans mixed with bacterial genes for built-in resistance to pests or weed killers. Despite international scientific consensus that GMOs are safe to eat, some people remain wary, and there is concern that they could spur herbicide-resistant weeds. Okay, so basically this is when you cross one element of one food with another food, whether it be an animal with an animal, whether it be a plant with a plant, or an animal with a plant, I guess, technically, if you would want that and that would serve some purpose. I'm not sure how you do that exactly. I mean, I do know how you do that, but depends who, what, when, where, and how. Either which way, generally, when we see like GMOs, we think like, oh gosh, it's going to be some like giant mutated creature which is being produced, and there's, people do remain wary.
Little
people are concerned. Sorry?
Little shop of horrors.
Basically. And they think, oh gosh, you know, they crossed this octopus with a rhinoceros, and now if I eat it, I'm going to die. Again, that's also not kosher, by the way. We're still working on the kosher. Okay. Now, gene editing tools with names like CRISPR and TALENs promise to alter foods more precisely and at less cost without necessarily adding foreign DNA. And this is key. Not necessarily when someone is gene editing are they going to add something in. It just might change something within the animal rather than crossbreeding it with something else or injecting some DNA from somewhere else where we know it's going to bring about some sort of trait. Here we're just going to touch as little as possible, so keep it as similar to what it used to be. Just make a tiny little change within the organism that we're dealing with, and to try to use that to improve our food. So, instead, they act like molecular scissors to alter the letters of an organism's own genetic alphabet. The technology can insert new DNA, but most products in development so far can switch off a gene. According to University of Missouri professor Nicholas, I don't even want to try to pronounce that, those new calyxed soybeans, Voita's team inactivated two genes so the beans produce oil with no heart-damaging trans fat and that shares the famed health profile of olive oil without its distinct taste. So what they did is they really, again, and how exactly they do that is a much longer biology sheer, but basically they can sort of inactivate or sometimes remove certain genes that produce things in a certain way, and through that, they are able to stop negative outcomes from whatever is being produced. In this case, with soybeans, they produce trans fats, knocking out or stopping a couple of the genes within these soybeans can say, you know what, instead of producing this type of fat or this type of chemical, they're producing a slightly different type of chemical or fat. In this case, one which is much healthier. And that's really what they've been doing here. Okay? Now, sometimes, as he says, you can add stuff in, and sometimes stuff will be added in to replace it. Not always is that from the same animal, not always is that from a different animal. Perhaps it can be lab-made. We're going to see a little bit more about it next page. Okay, the hornless calves. Most dairy Holsteins grow horns that are removed for the safety of farmers and other cows. Recombinetics Inc. swapped part of the gene that makes dairy cows grow horns with the DNA instructions from naturally hornless Angus beef cattle. Precision breeding is how animal geneticist Allison Van Inenam of the University of California, Davis, explains it. This isn't going to replace traditional breeding, but make it easier to add one more trait. So everything's still being bred traditionally. It's not like they're treating every single cow like this. But it just, again, makes it easier to add or remove one more trait about animals. And again, once these animals are breeding with these knocked out traits and this slightly altered DNA, that'll be passed on. And that'll be something very, very beneficial to animals and plants. Rules aren't clear, and here we go. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says extra rules aren't needed for plants that could otherwise have been developed through traditional breeding, clearing the way for development of about 24 gene-edited crops so far. In contrast, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration in 2017 proposed tighter drug-like restrictions on gene-editing animals. Page 2. It promises guidance sometime next year on exactly how it will proceed. Because of trade, international regulations are the most important factor in whether genome editing technologies are commercialized. USDA's Paul Spencer told a meeting of agriculture economists... that's what he told them, that last quote, sorry. Europe's highest court ruled last summer that existing European curbs on the sale of transgenic GMOs should apply to gene-edited foods too. But at the World Trade Organization this month, the U.S. joined 12 nations, including Canada, Australia, Argentina, and Brazil, and urging other countries to adopt internationally consistent science-based rules for gene-edited agriculture. And that's obviously something that these producers are hoping, you know, moves in that direction. And that way to say, let's look at it from a scientific point of view. Is this healthy? Is this not? And in general, people will say that gene-edited foods are going to be more healthy and more natural, so to say, than the GMOs, which really have other DNA really pushed in them, a lot of times without knowing what sort of side effects that could have. Yes, we know it might affect it in this positive way, but we don't know what else we're bringing in from that other source that could affect it. Are these foods safe? And that's what we continue. The biggest concern is what are called off-target edits, unintended changes to DNA that could affect a crop's nutritional value. Here we go, we've got a couple more sheets here. Or an animal's health, said Jennifer Kuzma of the Genetic Engineering and Society Center at North Carolina State University. Scientists are looking for any sign of problems. Take the hornless calves munching in a UC Davis field. One is female, and once it begins producing milk, Van Inanen Inenam, sorry, will test how similar that milk's fat and protein composition is to milk from unaltered cows. So on the one hand, yes, we are just simply manipulating one little part of it, one little gene. On the other hand, they still don't know, again, what sort of side effects that could have. So they are actually testing the milk fat, the protein composition, between these gene-edited cows, where, again, we've changed one slight small thing about them. We maybe replaced one gene from the cow that grows horns with a gene from the cow that doesn't grow horns. But we still don't know what type of ramifications that's going to have. And even though it shouldn't, you know, make that much of a difference, but maybe it can. So therefore, we're kind of being overly cautious. We're on page 2, about in the second paragraph, smack in the middle. She said, noting that if eating beef from naturally hornless Angus cattle is fine, milk from edited Holsteins should be too. But the Kuzma, companies will have to be upfront about how these new foods were made and the evidence that they're healthy. She wants regulators to decide case by case which changes are no big deal and which might need more scrutiny. Most gene-edited plants and animals are probably going to be just fine to eat, but you're only going to do yourself a disservice in the long run if you hide behind the terminology, Kuzma said, because what's going to happen is it'll start turning into, well, what is the length that we go to say this is genetically editing and this is genetically modifying, and hiding behind all sorts of technical terminology will not help the market in this case. But the point is that there is still some testing to be done when it comes to genetically edited food, gene-edited foods, less so than we would expect from GMOs, which are, again, have all sorts of other DNA put in, but altogether, they should still be, have some sort of safety regulation. Okay, uncertainty. Avoiding a backlash. Uncertainty about regulatory and consumer reaction is creating some strange bedfellows. An industry-backed group of food makers and farmers asked university researchers and consumer advocates to help craft guidelines for responsible use of gene editing in the food supply. Clearly, this coalition is in existence because of some of the battle scars from the GMO debates. There's no question about that, said Greg Jaffe of the Food Safety Watchdog Center for Science in the Public Interest, who agreed to join the Center for Food Integrity's Guidelines Group. There's clearly going to be questions raised about this technology. And again, because this is so brand new, we still have to find out how to deal with this as a society. And this is one part of it. Again, what's going to be the consumer reaction? How is it going to be regulated? These are big, big questions that are coming up with gene editing because it's so new. On the one hand, again, seems to be scientifically better and safer than GMOs. Not to say that GMOs aren't safe. On the other hand, we don't know how people are going to react. Sustainability or hype? Gene editing can't do everything, cautioned Calix Voites. There are limitations to how much foods could be changed. Sure, scientists made wheat containing less gluten, but it's unlikely to ever be totally gluten-free for people who can't digest that protein, for example, or to make, say, allergy-free peanuts. Nor is it clear how easily companies will be able to edit different kinds of food key to their profit. Despite our concerns about adequate regulation, Cosmo expects that about 20 gene-edited crops to hit the U.S. expects about 20 gene-edited crops to hit the U.S. market over 5 years. And she notes that scientists are exploring changes to crops like cassava that are important in the poorest countries. We think it's going to really revolutionize the industry, she said. And by changing animals in these ways and by changing plants in these ways, potentially you can increase production by making much smaller changes than we otherwise thought we needed. You can change the way things taste or the way things are digested. There's a lot to be done here, and it's really a groundbreaking technology that's, as you can see, it's close to coming into the market for all of us all around the world, really. And the truth is, I wanted to start the discussion with a bit of talk about Chelaeum in general, which is mixing two species, and this is less relevant to genetically edited foods and entirely relevant to GMOs. But even for gene editing, as we're going to see in the beautiful chart on the next page, which you can just turn to source number 2 and then we'll go back to the Rambam source number 1, you can actually see how it's done. I don't want to go through it. I'll let you take, again, about a minute to look through it. If you're, fluent in the science, then you'll do that. I don't want to sit here all day, though, explaining this. Some of which I'm not entirely 100% clear on, despite having taken biology probably more recently than most of you in this room.
Yes, indeed.
Yes. Okay. Okay. So, again, basically in short, it cuts up or cuts out a piece of DNA and then can either let it repair itself, which is what the, you know, not the body, but the organism itself will do. It has its own DNA repair mechanisms. Or it can sometimes, as you see in number five, step number five, it can actually add in a variation. That was the case of what happened with the hornless cows, right? That's what we mentioned in the article, that sometimes we do put in DNA from other places, and that's why our discussion of kilayim will be relevant to gene-edited foods. Not all gene-edited foods, but some gene-edited foods. And let's begin that discussion now. One thing I'm not going to talk about is the types of kosherous questions that come up with GMOs. GMOs are a way broader discussion because there you're actually taking one thing and introducing it into another thing. And sometimes you may have kosher animals crossed with non-kosher animals or just a little bit of non-kosher animal put in, and what's important about it, that's not something we're going to discuss. We're going to talk about actually gene editing, the process of the editing and the process of altering DNA in general, modifying genetics, and how that might relate to a halacha that's way ages old. And that halacha is that of kilayim. So, source number one, from the Rambam Hilchos Kilayim 1, 5 through 7, this is a bit of an overview about the types of kilayim that we'll be examining. We'll also be talking about kilayim of animals, but here this is first about kilayim of trees, which is basically grafting trees, and again, bringing part of one type of tree to another part of to another type of tree. So here we go. Grafting a mixture of trees, we'll read the English, is included in the prohibition. You shall not sow your field with mixed species. What is implied? When a person grafts a tree of one species onto a tree of another species, for example, he grafted a branch of an apple tree to an estroke tree, etc., he is liable for lashes according to scriptural law in any place, whether in Eretz Yisrael or in the diaspora. Similarly, if a person grafts a vegetable to a tree or a tree to a vegetable, he is liable for lashes in every place. So number one, we see there's a prohibition to graft from a fruit or vegetable to another fruit or vegetable, and this prohibition applies, unlike some of the other kilayim-based prohibitions, all over the world. It doesn't matter where you are. Some of the ground halachot of kilayim apply only in Israel, but these don't. Okay, so this grafting idea applies anywhere. You cannot do this. This is Torah law, straight from the Psukim, and we'll see the Psukim later, actually, when we get into a further discussion. And listen to this. Jews can't do this, but guess what? Look in the next halacha. It's forbidden for a Jew to allow a Gentile to graft different species of a tree together for a Jew. And again, same idea. How you know it is permitted to sow the seeds of produce and the seeds of a tree together. Similarly, it's permitted to mix seeds from different species of trees, etc., etc. And these are trees, okay? These are seeds as opposed to trees. There's different seeds is one type of kilayim, trees is another type of kilayim. And the rationale is that the only prohibition against mixed species that applies to trees is the prohibition against grafting. Okay, so you can't have a non-Jew graft together stuff for you. And that's, again, a prohibition. It's forbidden. However, if we turn the page to get for the English of the last halacha here, although he is liable for lashes, if this is done, meaning you plant your different types of seeds together that are not supposed to be planted, or you graft forbidden species of trees together, the produce that grows is permitted to be eaten. That is very, very, very important. Okay? So meaning, you can't do it. But if you do it, you can still eat it. Again, you're being over on an Isra de Oraisa. It's a serious thing. You can't do any of this. But at the end of the day, if the food's there, then you can eat it. Okay? And even if it's the person himself who did this avera, even they are allowed to eat it. And again, it is only the actual action that's forbidden and not the outcome of this action. I see I left source 17, the footnote there from the Chabad translation. I apologize. It's permitted to plant a branch from the grafted tree or plant the seeds from a vegetable that was planted together with mixed species. Okay, and you can plant that branch in return. Okay, meaning we have a grafted tree, and this is actually very relevant to almost all, scarily, of the produce that we eat nowadays, fruits and vegetables. Many, 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 it's not almost all, that may be an overstatement, I don't know exactly, but many, many, many of the fruits and vegetables that we eat are some combination of something, or were at some point modified by introducing some other DNA into them to make them better, rounder, more colorful, you name it. But again, you may plant that branch and again, grow the fruits from that. Again, it's only the action of mixing in first place that is prohibited. All clear? So this is like our overview of grafting together and the averas involved in it. By the way, the gene editing was source number two, not because it was meant to go second, the picture here, but because this is where I found space for it on a full page. Okay, if we turn to our, wow, fourth page already. We need to figure out whether or not introducing DNA, as we do in genetically modified foods, is something that falls under Kilayim. And we really have a good precedent to say that, you know what? There's something that's too small for the Torah to govern on. The Torah may only apply to things that are visible to the naked eye. And you may have heard this, and here's one of the sources that discusses this, the Aruch HaShulchan. Very, very interesting Aruch HaShulchan, as you'll see in a moment. Omnam! However, the Torah did not prohibit that which the naked eye cannot see. Not because it can't prohibit it, but because it didn't prohibit it. Okay, why? The Torah was not given to angels. If we can't see it, God's not going to make us do things that are, you know, beyond our capacity or too hard. Okay, this is something we see. It's something that comes up a lot. The logic behind it being, God knows we're human and we can't go crazy out of our minds in order to try to do something that would be very, very hard for us to do. And therefore, Dim Lokain, and if this was not the case, Harekama Meha Chokrim Kasvu, many of the scientists in his days had written, Shigam Kol Haavir Humalei Bruim Dakim Min HaDakim. All of the air is filled with the tiniest living creatures. Uchsheha'adam Poseach Piv, and anytime someone opens his mouth, Bolea Kama Mehem, you're swallowing many of these little tiny organisms in the air. Elavadai Dehevel Yifsepiem, now he thinks this is complete bunk. He's not willing to accept this. And he says, well, this is certainly not true. But, Ve'af Im Kain, but even if it were true, even if it is true, Kevan She'en Ha'ain Sholit Bahem Lav Klumu, you don't have to worry about it. So long as your eyes can't see it, Halacha says, don't worry about it for this case. And here he's talking about eating bugs, okay? And the same applies to, again, all sorts of microorganisms in all of the stuff that we have in water, in, right, billions and billions of things that we consume because they don't follow this. Even though you can see them in a microscope, that doesn't matter. Okay, so the simple understanding would then be to say, great, DNA is far, far too small for us to see. Yeah. So if I want to take a batch of DNA from one animal and quote-unquote graft it, meaning I want to insert it into another animal, or with plants, or, I mean, animals may be different, actually. We're going to talk about animals in just a little bit. But plants. Let's stick with our plants or our trees analogy. Right? If I want to take DNA from one type of fruit or vegetable and mix it in with another fruit or vegetable, I can just say, God will come up, hey, you're mixing vegetables. You're not supposed to mix vegetables and fruits together. Oh no, God, you can't see that, so it doesn't exist. Why would you reject such an argument, if you would? Why would you reject such an argument? I can think of two reasons to reject such an argument. One of them we're going to discuss, one of them I did not quote directly here. But let's, what have you got?
Should I ask the question, Caleb, please?
Why would you reject such an argument to say that just because this is below a visual level, this is subvisual, would you say that this doesn't count for the halachos of Kilayim? Why would you say that, no, that's wrong, I mean, and it does count?
You're purposely doing it as opposed to just drinking the water that you... I mean, you're actually manipulating it.
So and therefore what?
I think that seems different than having to explore whether there are bugs in the water. I mean... If you have the capability to do it, then you know it's there, mm-hmm. and then maybe it wouldn't be allowed.
Right, so what are you doing by taking out that DNA and putting it in somewhere else? You're saying, this exists, this is something significant. Right. It's less of a mistake versus something that you're doing on purpose, to me, but there's a concept in halacha called achshaveh, and this is not the word necessarily used here, but basically what it means is you can make something significant by your actions. And even though it would be insignificant halachically, in terms of DNA, let's say you had, I don't know, a minute droplet that you couldn't see of pig DNA floating in the air and it fell into your mouth, you're right, we wouldn't care about that. But here, you're taking it out of the animal, you're putting, or again, a plant or a tree, and you're putting it into something else. You're saying, I see it exists, I took it out of my syringe, and I... So, yes, it is visible. In that sense, it's still invisible, but it is still counted halachically, and that is the argument that Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach makes in Mincha Shlomo Tanyana 97:27. I have seen this tshuva quoted, and I had to quote it from Ariel Kaplan, who wrote an excellent 3-part article on this on KolTorah.org. He quotes Rav Shlomo Zalman, as do a lot of people, Rabbi Bleich and the next source, quotes from Shlomo Zalman, and they all quote this from 9727 Mincha Shlomo Tinyana. I searched and searched and searched. There is no 9727 in Mincha Shlomo Tinyana. I checked in Mincha Shlomo Volume 1. I just couldn't find it anywhere. Perhaps there is a 97. It's about something else. I thought perhaps... Yes, it was excellent.
Sorry.
Excellent. So, anyways, I couldn't find it, but it is quoted in a bunch of places, so we can see what it says in whatever version of it there was. I'm guessing the Sefer must have changed in some way, and we will quote another source from Minchat Shlomo Tinyana just a few comments later that actually says something different. So, however, this approach is directly rejected by Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach and Minchat Shlomo Tinyana, 9727, and Rabbi Yeshua Neuwirth, quoted Nishmat Avram, English, Volume 3, and other poskim who address the permissibility of genetic engineering, imply their rejection by admitting that the question exists. Rav Shlomo Zalman argues that one is actively involved in the genetic transfer, and this involvement is enough to make the transfer halachically significant. Okay, so that's Rav Shlomo Zalman's argument. And what's the other argument against it? So I do have it here, from Rav Neuwirth. He says, what happens after you inject that DNA into the tomato? What does the tomato look like then? It gets redder, it gets bigger. Huh? Visible. Yes, it itself is not visible at the time, but Rav Neuwirth adds that the results of genetic modification are often visible, unlike the microbial presence in fruit, which goes unnoticed. Either way, the point seems to be that we can ignore microscopic entities only so long as we ignore them. That is, provided we do not deal with them directly and cannot perceive their impact. However, if we involve ourselves in the microscopic world, we have no choice but to acknowledge the presence of microscopic entities and deal with them on halachic grounds. So, you know, that's really a beautiful summary of it and why this is potentially an issue when we're dealing with genetically modified foods. And as we said, to a lesser extent, with genetically edited foods, if we're bringing in something from somewhere else to add in after we're knocking out a gene. If we're just manipulating something within the animal, you can't say you're mixing it with something else. If you're just manipulating something within a fruit or within a vegetable, you can't say you're taking something in from something else. But if you do, you still got a potential problem. And let's see, do these problems exist?
So how different do the fruits have to be? If you have two different kinds of tomatoes, is that the same fruit or is that different fruit?
So that's a very, very good question as to what exactly Kilayim applies to and how different of a species it has to be. I don't know the answer to that question. From what I understand, if it's the same, let's just keep it at that. I don't want to make myself look more foolish than I already am.
The development of tomatoes we spoke about earlier.
Yes.
If you're just breeding Correct. Other kinds of strawberry
Correct.
Tomatoes.
Correct. And okay. I would assume, I'm not going to assume anything. Let's
Fair
move
enough.
On.
Okay.
Perfect. So now the question is, does this still pose a problem of Kilayim? And specifically, Kilayim on the one hand is grafting two real live, tree branches together, let's say. Those are both really trees on their own. What about if I'm just putting in a little bit of DNA? Does that really count as Kilayim? And we're going to talk about it for animals. If I put a little bit of animal DNA into another animal, is that Kilayim? And number two, if I put in, again, fruits and vegetables, in some way mixing them up, but it's just a little bit, does that count? So says Rabbi Bleich, quoting that same Mincha Shlomo, okay, the same one that I couldn't find anywhere. A similar principle applies to genetic manipulation of agricultural species. Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach, Mincha Shlomo 2, Tinyana, number 97, that should say section 27, declares that pollination of one species with pollen of another species does not result in a fruit that would be halachically classified as a hybrid. So if you take pollen from one plant and you cross-pollinate to another plant, that's okay, that's not considered kilayim, that's not a hybrid. The hybrid actually has to do with two halachos. One, which he's about to mention, is that an esro cannot be grafted with any other, cannot be mixed with any other type of fruit in order to improve the way it looks or anything like that. For any reason, it would be possible. But not only that, but it's not even kilayim, he says. Thus, although Rabbi Orbach affirms that the fruit of an etrog tree produced as the result of grafting of a lemon branch may not be used on Sukkot for purposes of fulfilling the mitzvah of the four species, he nevertheless regards pollination as an entirely different matter. Accordingly, rules Rabbi Orbach, if an etrog is pollinated with the pollen of a lemon tree, and the resultant fruit is an etrog, and may be used for fulfilling the mitzvah. Rabbi Orbach declares that the prohibition against hybridization of species applies only to the planting or grafting, pay very, very close attention, of vegetative material that might independently yield fruit or a seed capable of germinating independently. See, the word independently is there twice in the sentence to really emphasize it. Okay, Rav Shlomo Zalman, according to this tshuva, again, which I didn't see because I couldn't find, I asked other people, can you find this? No one found it anywhere. The point is, this is what he says, it's quoted in other places as well, and cross-pollination, because pollen itself cannot produce any sort of fruit, he says it does not fall under the ruling of kilayim, of grafting from one to the other, because it has to be two very significant, independent plants being crossed with each other. That's his psak. So again, pollen can never go into fruit. Hence, for purposes of halacha, introduction of foreign pollen does not affect species identity. Again, it is quite obvious that such pollution conducted artificially by humans is not prohibited. Similarly, it follows that the introduction of a gene of a foreign species is not forbidden as a form of hybridization, since an isolated gene can never develop into a tree or into a plant. And this, Rav Shlomo Zalman, there's something similar that's somewhat echoed by the Chazon Ish. I didn't want to get into the Chazon Ish because we'll have enough trouble with Rav Shlomo Zalman, as you'll see in a moment. But what Rav Shlomo Zalman is basically saying, according to these sources, is something very simple. It has to be two real plants that are being crossed with each other. If something that you take out, let's say you take out a gene or two from one plant and you want to put it in another plant, well, if you put that into the ground, would it grow? No, it wouldn't. So it's not a problem. End of story. That's Rav Shlomo Zalman here. The problem is the Minchat Shlomo that I was able to find, which was only three simanim later. Again, not that I saw the first one, but from where the first one was supposed to be. And here he's responding exactly to genetic engineering. B'inyan she'elato bidvar handasa genetit. About your question regarding genetic engineering. Shemachnisim chalkikei ta'im mi'beria achat l'shniya, where they insert basically cell particles from one living creature into another. U'vizem shanim et tochnotea shel ha'shniya. And through this, they can change the properties of the second, again, fruit, vegetable, whatever they're changing. Val yedei ze lehatir yisur kilayim mikevan she'ein chalkikim elu nirim le'ein ha'adam. And again, this person wanted to say that it should be permitted to do such a thing because it's not visible, it's subvisual. So he says, "Kevan she'anashim metaplim b'chalkikim ha'ele u'mavirim otam imin echad l'sheni, harei ze chashiv mamash kinirei la'einayim." It's considered as if it's visible, as we said, "V'lo da miklal l'tola'im she'enam nirim," and it's not at all similar, again, to these other sorts of little bugs, as they were called, that did exist, but were not visible, so were not counted by halacha. So that we saw already. Omnam, however, now he's going to get into the difference. He's going to say there's a difference between animals and between plants. Bebalei chayim, when it comes to animals, nireh laniyuta, tid'ein be'etzem ha'asiyah shum isur shel harba'a. There is no problem when you're genetically mixing two species of animals together, because it's not like harba'a. What's harba'a? Is having them mate with each other. Okay, that is the prohibition when it comes to animals, having one species of animal mate with another species of animal. Shor and chamor, you know, is part of it, whatever. Anyways, that's even for other actions. Sorry. So, in this case, why? It's only really taking these particles and moving it from one to the other, but it's not really, you know, you wouldn't call this mating them together. You're simply taking a little bit of DNA from one and putting it into the other. That's not considered mating. Okay, on the other hand, v'rak b'harkavat etzim nirei d'shap yirasur af im harkavah hirak al yedei zrikas shel mitz asher im hayazorei atamitz ba'adama lo hayatzo me'aklal. He says, but when it comes to trees, what's prohibited? Anything. Even if, he says, you take this and you put it in the ground and it wouldn't grow. Okay, literally the exact opposite of what he's quoted saying in the other tshuva. Okay? And again, kisof sof hasadeh, he said, at the end of the day, you look down at the field, and the field is zrua mishnei minim. It's planted with two different types of plants. That's what kilayim is. It's not about do they grow together. It's not about what is the outcome. It's the field can't be planted with these two different types of things. So therefore, he says, although this is not the case, where when it comes to harba'ah, he concludes you have to have a behema going, one behema combining with another, and a little bit of DNA is not called a behema, but it's not called an animal. But on the other hand, when it comes to fruits, vegetables, even this little bit of DNA, he says, no, I don't care that you put it in the ground and it wouldn't grow. You're still planting two species, or again, combining two species, and he says, therefore, it would be prohibited. Okay? I'm not going to try to reconcile these. There are people that do try to reconcile them. I can have a couple of ideas. The point is, though, there may be reason to be concerned when something like this is happening. They're not the only poskim, but there is some very, very important points. So this until now, we're talking about genetically modifying with applications to gene editing. Because again, sometimes in gene editing, we are putting in a little bit of DNA. Although this source would come and tell us that it's prohibited to do certain types of genetic modifying, would that equally apply to gene editing? So obviously, again, it wouldn't apply to anywhere where we're just knocking out a gene or manipulating something within an animal, but even when we're putting it in, notes Ariel Kaplan in source number 7, Rav Shlomo Zalman adds that a mixture of DNA within cells of one plant constitutes a violation of kilayim. However, and here's the key, the Chazon Ish actually limits to a certain level. Something is which is below a certain threshold is not considered to be kilayim. So, however, it's not clear if any amounts would constitute a violation of kilayim of animals, that should say plants, or if there's some specific threshold that must be passed for the transfer genetic material to be significant. Okay? So, it's possible that even if Shlomo Zalman would agree, if you're just taking a little sequence, 2-3 letters from somewhere else, whatever it is, and it's not so big, even he may have a threshold where he says, you know what, this is just nothing. Not because it's invisible, but because we can't even say it has enough, you know, to call it another plant. Perhaps he's saying that would be the case. So even within the most stringent view of Rav Shlomo Zalman, we do see that when it came to gene editing, perhaps you'd have more grounds to be lenient if it was really a small amount. Within other poskim, certainly you'd have grounds to be lenient. Within Rav Shlomo Zalman's first tshuva that we couldn't find, certainly you have grounds to be lenient. Within this, it's something to talk about. And, okay.
Aren't we still stuck with being able to perceive the outcome being changed? How do we get over that?
What is
saying that?
If
that once they do this manipulation, then the final product is different.
And therefore what?
Well, so even though the action was microscopic...
But here we're not going on the microscopic part. We're trying to figure out if it falls under the definition of what kilayim is.
If it turns into a different looking fruit, then it's a mix of something and something else.
Well, I mean, for...
Isn't it?
You could argue that, but that he seems to be... Again, depending on how you're looking at it, it may just not be kilayim depending on what you put in. It has to be classified as another species. If it's not classified as another species, graft all you want.
Which is kind of my tomato question, I guess. At the end of the day, though, no matter how this comes out, we can still benefit from all of this stuff.
Correct. We can still benefit for sure. Not even benefit, you can eat it.
Well, that's the benefit I meant. But
you cannot, let's say, be running a genetically modified foods company where you're telling people to do this stuff on a regular basis, potentially, again, in these specific cases outlined that we discussed above. So far we've said, you know what, halakhically it's probably not a problem. And certainly, again, gene editing where there's no addition of a foreign substance in is for sure not a problem, halakhically. But wait. Okay, here we go. Let's skip to 9, 10, 11, and I really should have put 8. I don't know why I put 8 there. 8 should have been after 11, but let's take a look at number 9 now. Okay, you shall not crossbreed different kinds of animals. You shall not plant your field with two kinds of seed, and neither shall there come upon you a garment made of two kinds of material. Okay, all the rules of kilayim. Why does Rashi say that kilayim are prohibited? Anybody want to guess based on the second word of the pasuk? Chukosai, what does chukosai mean?
It's a chok.
Says Rashi. Es chukosai tishmaru ve'elu hein. There's no reason. No rhyme or reason. Kilayim is prohibited. Okay, very nice. God said so. Okay, I'm going to follow you, God. Rambam actually offers something different. But
can I ask you one quick question on that? So was that the last one about clothing is different from the others because that means it's not manufacturing it, it's benefiting. You can't wear it.
Yes.
So that's kind of different from what you just said about plants and...
Yep. I mean, but that's already found in the pasuk.
Right.
Right? Meaning it's not that we have the same... It doesn't say don't make a clothing out of shatnez and don't plant your field and etc. It says don't mix your different kind of animals, don't mix your two types of seed, and something which is mixed may not come on you.
Right.
You already see in the pasuk there's that distinction. So, yes, you're right. It seems inconsistent, but the inconsistency is outlined, so to say, from the pasuk, saying this is what's prohibited, not this.
Genetically modified wool that you make sweater.
I don't think anybody's looking to genetically modify these things. I think it's enough that you can stitch them together. I have not heard of that. Maybe you can change sheep to produce a different type of wool. I don't know. But yes, that would be something. But according to Rashi, as we said, there's no rhyme or reason. This is just something that's not allowed. On the other hand, Ibn Ezra and many, many, many others, including the Sefer HaChinuch, but I thought he said it nicely. V'tam lehaskir achar ilah mitzvot b'emdechalot abir kilayim lehaskir achar yotcha kadosh, is in Parshas Kedoshin, I believe. After you are becoming holy, or it's certainly talking about, again, holiness before that, lo ta'aseh chamas leven adam kamocha. Okay, don't do mean things to other people, which was right before this. Gam lo ta'aseh labhema lishanos ma'aseh Hashem. You also shouldn't do bad to animals, but what specifically shouldn't you do? You don't mess with what God did. God made something one way, you don't mess with it. Now, may I pose you the question? Between Rashi and Ibn Ezra, who do you think would look kindly upon gene editing in animals? Rashi. Rashi says there's no rhyme or reason. You can't mix two breeds, goodbye. On the other hand, Ibn Ezra, and I think Rashbam, Ramban, a whole boatload of Rishonim, they all say, God does something one way, you don't interfere. And mixing two animals together to make a third type of animal is interfering. So perhaps, ethically, and again, we can't say this is a halachic prohibition. We don't derive halachos from a reason that some people give to a mitzvah. But ethically, there maybe is something to be worried about. So now let's jump back to source number 8. Here we go. Based on the positions of these two towering giants, we may well understand the issues noted in the previous section. The comments of Ramban and others notwithstanding, we should likely build our perception of the ethical issues out of the halachic principles, which, as noted, severely limit the kilayim restrictions. Although Rav Moshe certainly leaves room for ethical principles, the idea of building the world and benefiting humanity likely overshadow an ethical imperative to avoid tampering with nature. Considering what two major halachic authorities of Eretz Yisrael of the previous century, the Chazanish and Shlomo Zalman Orbach, did not mention hashkafic implications of kilayim, and the two great American halachic decisors, Rav Moshe Feinstein and Rav Soloveitchik, minimized the implications of a Gadic explanation of mitzvot, it would seem that the combined trend of recent Torah authorities should limit the ethical restrictions of kilayim and favor pursuit of genetic engineering. And what this really comes down to is exactly what he's described here. Yes, we can find Rishonim that say, you know what, it doesn't seem right to mess with what God did. And that's the reason for kilayim, and that would too apply to gene editing. Perhaps to even more of an extent. Meaning, mating two animals together seems almost less intervening. God made two animals, he made them able to mate, it's not so crazy. But now you're going in, you want to tweak something little, that would seem almost even ruder, so to say, to God. But yet, when we look at the benefits that can come from this, it's amazing. I mean, you know, you saw in that article, the things that people can do now, you just knock out a little gene here, a little gene there, and the benefits that we can get in terms of the value to the world, perhaps now is not the time to look at these Torah ethical concerns, especially when the halachos which grow out of them, which are really directives for us, don't apply to these cases. I think that's a great way to conclude with this, at least for this part. Now we have one more which I couldn't resist, because it was just such a crazy case. And you can see the headline at the bottom of the page. Wyoming man argues against death penalty in fetus death. This is quite the groundbreaking, interesting case. Jackson, Wyoming. A Wyoming man charged with killing his girlfriend in Idaho in July 2016 argues the death of her unborn baby does not qualify as, ready for this, a second murder that makes him eligible for the death penalty. Attorneys for 41-year-old Eric Olson of Jackson say it's a legal insanity for Idaho law to protect a first trimester fetus under the homicide law, but not under the abortion law. Olson is charged with killing 39-year-old Jennifer Nally and her unborn baby. His trial is set for July 2019 in Bingham County, Idaho. A woman and her doctors can kill an embryo or fetus in the first trimester without repercussions from the law, Olson's attorneys Jim Archibald and John Thomas wrote in their November 9th motion to dismiss the murder charge related to the fetus. To say a potential mother has protection from being prosecuted, but a potential father does not have protections, violates equal protection under law. They argue the 12-week-old fetus wasn't old enough to have a right to life. Eric Olson was put on notice that a fetus in his first trimester could be killed, they wrote. He knew this personally, as two different women he had relationships with had aborted or killed their first trimester fetuses. We really are getting an idea for what type of person this is. The attorneys also argued the fetus didn't die because it was shot, but because Nally was shot. There was no autopsy or death certificate, surprise, for the fetus, meaning Olson can't be charged with a second count of murder, and that was what they were arguing. And in regards to the general case, prosecutors plan to use text messages apparently sent by Olson as evidence for premeditation in Nally's death. She seems to be interested in having this baby without me, except for when it comes to money, investigators said Olson texted to a friend just before the shooting. I want to strangle her and witness her last mortal moment. Wow. A motions hearing is set for December 7th, the Jackson Hole News and Guide reported. Yikes. But what it does bring up is a very interesting question. I mean, this article is fascinating. We could spend a whole lot of time on this. I wanted to talk about the idea of killing someone and causing their fetus to be killed as halacha. The abortion question is a much bigger question, and we will touch on it a tiny, tiny bit in these last few sources, because this is really where it comes from. But especially in this case where we're looking at this becoming a second murder, which makes this person liable for the death penalty. That's what's so mind-blowing about this whole discussion, is that if there's a second murder, they can put him on the death penalty. Otherwise, not like there's a whole lot to unpack in this. But either which way, a fascinating news article, and something which has a lot of relevance to Torah. How? Well, we just so happen to have a case in the Torah, in Parshas Mishpatim, that talks about something remarkably more similar than you might have thought. Says the Torah in Shemos, Chaf Aleph, Pesukim Chaf Bez and Chaf Gimel, V'chein Atzu Anashim, if men fighting. Men are fighting. V'nagifui shahara, they pushed or they punched or they hit or they hurt a pregnant woman. V'yatzu yaladeha, and she gives birth prematurely, meaning she miscarries. V'lo yihyeh ason, and there will not be anything bad that happens, as Rashi notes in the next source, ba'isha, to the woman herself, meaning unfortunate, terrible thing. The fetus is now no longer viable. She miscarries. But on the other hand, she's fine. She walks away otherwise unscathed. Anoshi aneshi will be punished. Fined. Kasher yashisala valaisha, as much as the woman's husband demands, which is not exactly the way it works in halacha, as Rashi notes there, but we're not going to get into that. Vinasan biflilim, and, you know, the judges allow, basically, this is how much he has to pay. Vim ason yihyeh, but if there's any harm to the woman, meaning he kills the woman, vinasata nefesh tachas nefesh, then you must take life for life. And let's see Rashi here. Rashi tells us, vim ason yihyeh ba'isha, which is the next pasuk, if there's something terrible that happened to her, V'nasata nefesh tachas nefesh. You have to give a soul for a soul. So, how do we generally interpret something for something else? Soul for a soul, eye for an eye? Money. We always like to say money, money, money. Well, wait, says Rashi. Rabosinu chalukim badar. There's actually machlokas about this in the Gemara. Yesh omer, some say, nefesh mamish. If you kill a woman, you're chay of misa. So here, nefesh tachas nefesh is literal. You killed her, you get killed. V'yesh omrim, Mamon avalon nefesh mamish. No, you only have to pay money for her life here. Why? A very interesting point. Shehamis kavein laharogezeh v'harogezeh patur mimisa. When you were shooting just now, who were you shooting at? I was shooting at the guy I wanted to kill. I wasn't trying to shoot at the pregnant woman. She just got in the line of fire. Oh, if that's the case, that's when you tried to kill one person, you accidentally killed another person, we can't give you the death penalty. Okay, and that's the halacha based on this. Now, what's very interesting, notes the Rashbam, and this may be the halacha for a number of reasons, but says the Rashbam, v'nasata nefesh tachas nefesh, you have to pay with your life. What don't you pay for, though?
The fetus.
The fetus. Mm-hmm. The fetus is dead, the same way as it was last pasuk. But you know what? You killed her, you're getting the death penalty, you don't have to pay for damages that happened there.
Yet,
quite the parallel.
If memory serves, you do with animals, right? I mean, if a cow that's expecting gets killed, and then I think you have to pay more than if it wasn't expecting or something like that. Is that not right?
I don't know the exact details with animals. Right. I'm not familiar with those halachos. I do know that in terms of the cost of what's going on, in terms of determining the cost in the previous pasuk, halachically, we look at what such a woman's slave market value would be,
right?
Which is part of that we look at her.
So why aren't we doing that?
It could be, that if we were paying money, it would be, I believe we'd say we don't pay for her money, we pay his money, what he's worth for his life. He has to pay the money that his life is worth, not what her life is worth.
Right. Okay.
So that's why it's different. But anyways, this is a case where we're basically saying someone went in and killed both a mother and her baby, and we're dealing with only what happened to the mother,
and this, which is this baby exactly could be 8.5 months pregnant. As
that's
well.
Another story. I mean, again, this relates more to abortion and what's considered pregnant and not pregnant. But, you know, it is very important within the law. But in halacha, though, we do see this incredible parallel where we're talking about where a pregnant woman is killed and her child dies, unfortunately, with her. And we're saying, you know what, you have to focus on the person you killed. You're not also liable for the fetus that you unfortunately caused to die as well.
Would you be liable if only the fetus killed and the mother was fine?
Yes, that's the first pasuk.
That's the first pasuk.
And you're not liable for death in that case. Well, you may be. We're going to see. That's the next source. Excellent. Okay, now there's another pasuk which I couldn't quote for lack of space. Lack of space with 6 pages. Look how we've fallen. Right, this is. You know, I used to insist on 4, and now we've gotten all the way up to 6, and we still run out of space. That, you know, but listen, it's good. We're learning more Torah, or maybe more news articles. The Torah tells us a very interesting pasuk in Parshas Noach. The Torah says, "Shofech dam ha'adam," one who spills the blood of a man, "ba'adam damo yishafech," through man his blood will be spilled. Meaning, there's a death penalty for killing people. However, you can read that pasuk in a slightly different way. You can read it as, and the Gemara in Sanhedrin tells us that this is one way to read it, "Shofech dam ha'adam ba'adam," if one spills the blood of man within man, meaning a person within a person, which is a fetus, "damo yishafech," he suffers the death penalty. Now, how could you possibly read it that way? That would be 2 contradictory laws in the Torah. Mm-hmm. Well, where's this law? The one that we're talking about right now here on our source sheets? That's in Parshat Mishpatim. That's for Jews. That's at Matan Torah. We do apply the original law, which was a Noahide law, said to Noach, based on this drasha of Shofech Tam HaAdam VaAdam, that if you kill a baby, 2 non-Jews. It says the Rambam, Hilchos Malachim, Ben Noach Sheharag Nefesh, a Gentile who slays any soul, Afilu Ubar Bimei Imo, even just a fetus in its mother's womb. I shouldn't say just, even a fetus in its mother's womb. Neharag alav, should be executed in retribution for that. V'chinim harag treifa, o shekapsa v'nasnu l'fnei ari, o shenichu barav, ad shemes, hoel v'hemis mikol makom neharag, v'chinim harag rodef, sheyachol atzil b'achar me'ifarav neharag alav, ma she'ein kein b'Yisrael. These laws do not apply in regard to Jews. There's a whole bunch of laws where we are actually stricter on people that received the killing law from the times of Noah than we have now. Which is also very interesting to our case, because we're talking about a death penalty for killing a fetus, in and of itself. So I thought these were a couple of very interesting parallels. By no means do they solve the problem halachically, nor do they tell us what we should do. There's all sorts of other halachic questions that tie into this, but 2, again, very interesting cases that really relate directly to this news story that I thought were worth hearing, worth discussing. Again, there's so much more on this topic to talk about, but I hope I gave you at least a flavor, pun intended, for the first article, and of the halachos that relate to this, and I look forward to seeing you guys, not next week again, but the following week. Next week we have the special Shloshim here at Shul. I hope to see you at the Shloshim, just not in this room because I won't be here. So thank you very much.
Thank you.